Every year, the New Yorker throws a big festival that lasts the whole weekend. And in 2016, I had the pleasure of sitting down for an hour on stage with one of the great musicians of our time, one of the great human beings, really, somebody I've admired since I'm a kid. And I'm hardly the only one. This event sold out, I kid you not, in 6 seconds. I first set eyes on Bruce Springsteen in June of 1973. I was 14, a North Jersey boy, and I told my parents some outrageous lie about what I was doing, and I took a bus across the river all by myself to New York City. I had a $4 ticket to see a band called Chicago, which was a huge band at the time, and they had a big hit called 25 or 6 to 4. I have no idea what that means. And I climbed to the highest seat in Madison Square Garden, the blue seats, and out trundled the opening act, a skinny guitar slinger and songwriter from down the shore. And this guy was outrageous. He was like the white James Brown. He was singing, dancing, stabbing at his guitar, leading the band with a crazy urgency, bursting all the while through the indifference of a huge arena crowd that had not come to see him. They had come to see Chicago. And in every sense, he was brilliant. And soon things exploded. One reviewer wrote about him, and this is John Landa, who became his manager, "I saw rock and roll's future." And that was the consensus view of Springsteen in rock and roll circles. He was the future, and he was on the cover of Time and Newsweek in the same week. And now, 40 years later, plus 20 Grammys, an Academy Award, and a Presidential Medal of Freedom all behind him, Bruce Springsteen is starring on Broadway in a performance called Springsteen on Broadway. And in the show, he performs solo and tells stories from his autobiography, Born to Run. The book, which came out in 2016, is as vivid as his songs, with that same pedal-to-the-floor quality and just as honest and intimate about the struggles in his own life.
Hello.
Welcome, Bruce.
Thanks.
So, let me ask you this. People tend to write their memoirs at different points in their lives. Some, Barack Obama wrote his when he was, I think, barely in his 30s. You've waited. You've probably thought about this over the years. No? Why now?
Well, I wanted to do it before I forgot everything, you know? So it's getting a little edgy with some of that. So this was the time.
Did you do any research? Did you think, oh my, I forgot all about X, Y, or Z, and I have to go look at the clips, or John Landau's going to remind me, or Patty's going to remind me?
I had a few friends I called up. Buddy George Thies was in the Castiles with me. I gave him a call, and we threw around some of the Castiles memories. But I didn't do much research on it, no.
You tell us at an incredibly revealing moment, just after a long passage about a really difficult time you had not too many years ago. You call it Condition Red. It was a prolonged depression. And then you break it off, and you say, writing about yourself is a funny business. At the end of the day, it's just another story, the story you've chosen from all the events of your life.
Of course.
What did you feel that you couldn't write about? Because this is a pretty brutally honest book about yourself.
That I couldn't write about?
Yeah.
I don't want to talk about that. If we could talk about it, I would have written about it.
It's just between us.
Basically, I tried to find a way I could write about most of my experience. You know, you had to find the right voice, and you had to find a voice you were comfortable in opening up your life and revealing parts of yourself that normally might feel awkward. And then I suppose the trickiest part to write about was the third section of the book, where it's all people you're living with and people you currently, you know, have a life with, and so you're a little more sensitive about that section. And Patty was very helpful with me there.
As a censor, or?
No, not really. She cut me a lot of slack and gave me a lot of room to express myself, you know? So I have to thank her for that.
T-Bone Burnett once said that rock and roll is one long scream of, "Daddy!"
Wow! Yeah. I believe that's true, you know? It's true in my case anyway.
And your father and his the reality of your relationship and his difficulties and the anxiety it caused you when you're young and its afterlife and its profound influence on your work is a dominant part of this book. And I wondered if you could read, there's a passage on page, in fact, 29 we discussed before we came in.
Yep.
Get out those reading glasses.
Put those cameras down.
I only use them in bed.
There it is.
All right. Okay. Here we go. Unfortunately, my dad's desire to engage with me always came after the nightly religious ritual of the sacred six-pack. It was one beer after another in the pitch dark of our kitchen. It was always then that he wanted to see me. It was always the same. A few moments of feigned parental concern for my well-being, followed by the real deal. The hostility and raw anger toward his son, the only other man in the house. It was a shame. He loved me, but he couldn't stand me. He felt we competed for my mother's affections. We did. He also saw in me too much of his real self. My pop was built like a bull, always in work clothes. He was strong, physically formidable. Toward the end of his life, he fought back from death many times. Inside, however, beyond his rage, he harbored a gentleness, a timidity, shyness, and a dreamy insecurity. These are all the things that I wore on the outside. And reflections of these qualities in his boy repelled him, made him angry. It was soft. He hated soft. Of course, he'd been brought up soft, a mama's boy just like me. One evening at the kitchen table, late in life, when he was not well, he told me a story of being pulled out of a fight he was having in the schoolyard. My grandmother had walked over from our house and dragged him home. He recounted his humiliation and said, eyes welling, I was winning. I was winning. He still didn't understand. He could not be risked. He was the one remaining living child. My grandmother, confused, could not realize her untempered love was destroying the men she was raising. I told him I understood that we'd been raised by the same woman in some of the most formative years of our lives, and suffered many of the same humiliations. However, back in the days when our relationship was at its most tempestuous, these things remained mysteries, created a legacy of pain and misunderstanding.
I think, Bruce, part of the emotional power of that is that you understand so much of it now, but in real time, as a young person, you understood so little. In other words, what's the gulf? How long did it take you to begin to understand him from the inside?
Well, let me see. 35, 40, I don't know, 50 years, two psychiatrists, one died on me already. Long time.
I wrote a piece about you some years ago, and I was interviewing Steve Van Zandt. He said, you have to understand, even if your father wasn't ill, the gulf between fathers and sons, these are fathers, in particular fathers, who, in his words, won the war in Europe and came home, built the suburbs, doing jobs that they hated. And meanwhile, their sons were growing their hair long and listening to music they didn't understand and taking drugs and doing all kinds. The gulf was unbelievable.
Yeah, it was impossible at the time, really. You know, there was, it was just that moment in history. You know, there were two alternate realities occurring at the same time. And really coming from where my father came from, it was impossible to understand, you know. When I grew my hair, and I mean, everybody's in the audience, many of the people in the audience, I'm sure, had the same experience. It was just split the house down the middle, and those were the times.
And at the same time, in this book, there's a kind of a heroic enlightening presence in your life and in this book that's a kind of counterpoint to your father, and that's your mother. And one of the most touching things about it is that she not only, by force of will, holds this family together, but is also a musical presence in your life. She's sitting there watching this music that you would have thought was incomprehensible to someone of her generation. She loved it.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about it, she was, you know, when I was 13, what was she, 30? She's only in her early 30s, probably, you know. You know, mid-30s. And so she was excited by Elvis Presley, and she was interested in the Beatles. And she had, we had the radio on top of the refrigerator that played top 40 music every morning when you came downstairs. Music was a big part of her life, and she was, you know, we always had the radio on in the car, so I heard all the hit records of the day, and I think music was kind of passed down in the Italian side of my family. They all played piano a little bit, and of course there was a lot of singing and carrying on. You know?
But you couldn't you couldn't possibly have thought that this is my way out, the way some kids will think about sports.
No, it was just something that obsessed me when I was young, and you didn't have any idea where it was going to take you, you know. I mean, you looked at the covers of those records and you dreamed and dreamed of, but it was a million miles away, so.
In fact, you dreamed, very specifically, you dreamed about being Mick Jagger. And that he'd call you up and he'd say, I have the flu.
Yeah.
Can you fill in?
Yeah. I had a good one. It was, Mick gets sick, and they're
as
playing,
one does.
They're playing at Asbury Park Convention Hall, and they need somebody. So there's this, you know, pimpled young 15-year-old kid in the front rows, and so Keith says, come on up, help us out. And I get up, and of course, you know, the crowd goes wild. You know, that was my that was my dream.
So, why was Asbury such a big music scene? It's not such a big place. It's pretty far from New York, but it had an incredibly lively music scene, an outsized lively music scene at that time.
It was like a Jersey Shore, Fort Lauderdale. It was a place where you know, people came to. The summer, you know, was a big season, and bands came from all over to fly their wares there in Asbury. So it was a center for top 40 bands who came in, played all the little beach clubs and nightclubs, and it was just a natural gathering place for musicians. And it had a very, very unusual club called the Upstage Club, where that was open from 8 to, there were no survivors, so whoever's clapping, I don't believe you were there. But it was open from 8 to 5, which was very unusual. Sold no booze, so you could be a kid and get in. And the bars closed at 3, so those final 2 hours, every musician would line up on the street outside the Upstage to get in and play the music that they really wanted to play in the club after hours. So there was an amazing clearinghouse for musicians.
When I listen to what surviving records there are and recordings from those early days and read about it, it seems like a million influences are going on at one time. You had one band that was kind of like Mad Dogs and Englishmen. It was this gigantic band. You had a trio at one point. You're playing kind of...
Yeah, I had tried it all, you know, so... but it was just different. I was kind of following the times a little bit, you know, when... I had a nice three-piece band that was fun to play in, where I got to play a lot of guitar, and we kind of half-assed Jimi Hendrix and the Cream stuff, you know. And I had a big band, 10-piece band, similar to the band we had out on the Wrecking Ball tour, where there was a couple of horns and a couple of singers, and we played a lot of R&B and all original music. So I bounced around in a lot of different genres trying to find something that settled me.
And you played teen clubs, you played, I think, even trailer parks, and you even played the Marlboro Psychiatric Hospital. If I'm right, you played the Animal song, We Gotta Get Out of This Place.
Yeah.
Good set list.
We just played all over, you know, and somehow we got booked at the psychiatric hospital, and it was My main recollection was a guy got up on stage and gave a long introduction of the band. Went on. We were waiting to go on. Then somebody came up and took him away.
And at some point, though, you realized, I'm a good guitar player, but I'm not Jimi Hendrix. I'm a good singer, but maybe I'm not Roy Orbison. And my way to become an original is to write my own songs. How does that start? How do you have the kind of, give yourself the permission to sit down and create for yourself?
Well, we played a lot, and we'd been around a lot by that time. You know, I'd traveled across the country a couple of times with the band, and we'd seen some other bands, and I we thought we were pretty good. But I would occasionally bump into somebody who I said, well, they got a little bit of an edge on us. And I'd come home, and at some point, I was in my early 20s, and I just tried to assess my talents one by one. And I said, well, guitar player. Well, I'm a good guitar player. Better than a lot of guys. I'm not the best. So, singer. Well, that's a tough one, you know? I never thought I had much of a voice. So I'm going to have to learn how to sing as best as I can. But I'm never going to make my way just as a singer, you know? Plus, I'd been writing all along. But I was at a moment where I just came to a crossroads, and I said, well, if I'm going to take the next step, I'm going to have to write some songs that are fireworks, you know, that I'll be able to put across with just the guitar, my voice, and my song, because I wasn't working in a band at the time. And I felt I needed to do something that was more original, and I just sat down at the piano and I just started to hack out the songs from Greetings from Asbury Park.
Princess cards she sends me with her regards.
Oh, Bruce Springsteen. I spoke with him in 2016 at the New Yorker Festival. Bruce realized that if he was going to make it, he had to make it as a songwriter. And pretty quickly after that, he had a life-changing encounter with John Hammond, the record producer who had discovered everybody from Billie Holiday to Bob Dylan. We're going to hear exactly how that went down in a minute on the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Not what I came for, and I'm sure you see that too. I came for you.
Springsteen is such a huge part of the pop landscape that it's hard to remember now just what a bombshell he was when he broke out 40-some years ago. If you remember back, that was a kind of iffy moment in rock and roll. Music seemed bloated all of a sudden. It was loud, but not so much fun and not really very interesting. It was fragmenting into all different genres and not all of them very good. And then here came Springsteen, whose music had everything at once. It had brains, it had soul, it had muscle, it had heart. And that was all present from his very first album. Now, at an early point, you managed to get an audition with the great John Hammond, who had discovered any number of jazz greats as well as Bob Dylan. We were going to hear just one of those songs that's also on this album, Chapter and Verse, which accompanies the book. So, a bit from Growing Up.
Well, I stood stone like at midnight, suspended in my masquerade, and I combed my hair till it was just right, and commanded the night brigade. I was open to
that was the recording with the band, but sitting across from John Hammond with just your guitar in an office.
Right.
How did he seemed to know right away, as he's that, and that has happened historically any number of times. Leonard Cohen, Bob Dylan, Billie Holiday, Count Basie.
That was a wild, wild day because I didn't have an acoustic guitar. So I had to borrow one from Vinny Skibots Maniello, who was the original drummer in the Castiles.
You just made up that name, didn't you?
No. There was a Baby Bots and a Mrs. Bots also. But so I borrowed a guitar. So Vinny lent me the guitar, but it didn't have a case. So I have to get on the bus, and I got to go to New York with kind of the guitar over my shoulder, which is very embarrassing, you know? It's...
But mythological almost. I mean,
yeah. Yeah. So we get to the city, and amazingly enough, the music business at that moment was such that John Hammond, one of the greatest A&R men and producers of our time, were seeing idiots off the street, you know? You know, that was the lay of the land, amazingly enough. So I remember it was me and Mike Appel, and Mike Appel had talked his way in, which is just was the single greatest thing he ever did. And we were going up in the elevator, and I was a little nervous. I just read the Anthony Scaduto biography of Dylan, where there's so much about John Hammond in it. So I had two choices. I could say, well, okay, this is your moment, Mr. Big Shot, when you're going to see if you've got anything or you don't. I decided not to do that to myself. And instead, I tried to do a little mental jujitsu where I said, well, I have nothing. So I have nothing to lose. If nothing happens, I'm going to walk out the same as I walked in. And yeah, I almost convinced myself of it by the time I got up there. I couldn't completely buy my own, but I tried. But we went in, and there was John Hammond sitting across this very small room, you know, not much bigger than his carpet, little tiny corner room, had the gray suit on, the tie, the gray flat top haircut, the horn rim glasses. And we walk in, and Mike Appel, my manager, immediately begins to hype me. I'm the next biggest thing since Shakespeare and Bozo the Clown, and tells John Hammond that he brought me to him to see if he really had ears or if discovering Dylan was a fluke. Now, I'm standing there with my naked guitar, having one of the biggest weenie shrinkers of all time. And, you know, so Mike is happy that he said his piece, and he goes and sits on the windowsill and folds his arms. And John Hammond says, who was ready to hate us by that time, says, well, play me something. So I sat down, and I closed my eyes, and I played him Saint in the City.
Well, I had skin like leather and the diamond hard look of a cobra. I was born blue and weathered, but I burst just like a supernova. Well, I walked like Brando right into the sun, and danced just like a Casanova. Well, with my black jacket and hair slick sweet, silver star studs on my duds like a Harley and Heat. And when I popped down the street, I could hear its heartbeat. Fell back and said, don't that man look pretty? The cripple on the corner cries nickels for your pity. And the gasoline boys downtown, they sure talk gritty. It's so hard to be a saint in the city.
And when I was done, I looked up. He had that big smile on his face that you got to be on Columbia Records.
Now, 30 seconds before he said that,
oh, yeah.
What was your alternative future?
Back down the elevator.
But no kidding around. What would that have been? What would have been the other path for you that you had to have in your mind sometimes?
I was a musician at the time, so I would have just, you know, kept on playing music. That was all I knew how to do. I had absolutely no other skills. And so,
so would it have been like Steve Van Zandt, who went off and was a construction worker for a while, or somebody, you know, to make it happen?
I couldn't have done that, you know. I just didn't have the skills, you know. So
you could learn.
Basically, I probably would have went back to Asbury and thrown a little band together and just found a bar to play in and kept swinging on it.
Now, one element we haven't discussed is that the great addition to the musical presence of your playing was Clarence Clemons. And this was not just somehow a musical addition to the band. This was a spiritual dimension to it. Shamanistic, that's the word you use in the book.
Yeah. A band is a dream. You know, it's a dream that you have. It's a dream that all your band members are having. It's a dream of another world, of some other place. You know, a place that feels adventurous, that feels, I suppose, safe, that where you feel you're accepted. And a real band is a very, 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 very particular and special thing. So the connections you make amongst your band members become near sacred positions as you get older. Clarence was like a dream I had, you know. I'd been looking for years for a saxophonist because I love the great sax solos from the Great Soul records and the Dion records, and I just wanted to hear that sound, you know. And a real rock and roll saxophonist is hard to come by, you know. You don't want a jazz guy that'll come in and kind of slum with you. You need somebody who just is an R&B player. And that was Clarence. Clarence was playing with a band called Little Melvin and the Invaders. They were a local soul band that Gary Talent happened to be playing bass in. So Clarence was a bit mythic in the area before anyone met him, with the exception of Gary. And then, of course, he came into the club we were playing in one night, and he wandered to the stage and asked if he could sit in, and he got up, and the sound that came out of his saxophone was a real force of nature. It was, you know, so I get to stand next to Clarence and I hear Clarence's sound before it goes into the microphone. It was just an amazing thing to stand next to and to hear. And then also Clarence's presence was unique. You know, he was just a unique person on the planet. You know, he was just only one of them.
Let's play the beginning of a song that's the title track of the book, like if we can call it that.
Okay.
You've heard of that song. So a lot is going on there. You've got Peter Gunn and Duane Eddy and Elvis and Dylan and you and a million things going on all at once.
Everything I could think of.
But seriously, it is everything you could think of. It's everything you could get in there, isn't it?
Oh, it was. I threw the kitchen sink and everything else at it. You know, it was... I talk about it in the book. I said I wanted to make a record that felt like okay, this is the last record you're ever going to hear. And then the apocalypse, my friend. And so I wanted to make a sound that would feel like that. You know, it would feel completely cathartic, you know, over the top. You know, I was trying to make one of the greatest records I'd ever heard, you know, so.
And you succeeded, God knows. And if you, and yet if I remember when the record was finished, rather than release it, you threw it into a swimming pool because you didn't think it was ready yet.
Well, I had second thoughts. You know? I had second thoughts, but I have second thoughts about everything. So the record came down and the album was supposed to be done, and I'm not sure if I was ready for it to be done because it would mean people were going to hear it. And I wasn't sure I was ready for that. So Jimmy Iovine visited me somewhere out on the road in Richmond, Virginia, I think, and we played it. We had to go down to a stereo store in town because there were only records in those days, and you needed a record player, and you didn't carry one on the road. So you had to go to the record player store and ask the guy if you could play your album on one of their systems. So we went in the back, and Iovine was walking back and forth and back and forth and watching me to see what my response was. And my response internally was, I just want to get out of here, you know. I don't want to have to listen or think anymore. And I think at the end of the day, we came back to the motel, and I threw it in the pool, and that was my... But it all worked out later, I think... I think John Landau helped me out. He said, look, you know, sometimes the things that are wrong with something are the same things that make that thing great. And that's the way it is in life, and that's the way art works. So I said, well, all right, let's put it out.
And then you take this stuff on the stage, and the performances in the mid-70s and into the late 70s get more and more developed, longer, as if you are trying to lose yourself on stage. It's really like no other performances that we had seen, anybody had seen until that moment, except maybe from James Brown and in soul music. What were you up to there? Why so long?
Losing myself was a big, something I was shooting for, you know? I'd had enough of myself by that time to want to lose myself. And so I went on stage every night to kind of do exactly that. You know, playing is orgiastic. It's a moment of both incredible self-realization and self-erasure at the same time. You disappear and blend into all the other people that are out there, and into the notes and the chords and the music that you've written, you kind of rise up and vanish into it. And that was something I was pursuing. You know, I was pursuing intoxication. You know, why have people gotten intoxicated since the beginning of time? Why will the war on drugs never be successful? Because people need to lose themselves. We can only stand so much of ourselves.
But on that topic, you didn't lose yourself in drugs. In fact, you had a no drugs rule for yourself, well, and the best you could manage.
I was too frightened. It took me so long to find a piece of myself that I could live with that I was very frightened with losing that when it came to other substances, you know. Plus, I'd lived around a lot of drug takers. I'd seen some of the really worst effects. You know, I'd had friends that killed themselves and friends that really kind of went and never came back. And so I was very frightened of it, so it wasn't for me.
You once said that the audience part...
I'll take some now, however.
Yeah.
If you have any.
I've got something here.
All right.
I think I've got 14 beta blockers, if you'd like to share. Okay. You once said that for the audience's part, they come not to learn something, but to be reminded of something when they come to see a performer like you or something that they love deeply.
Yeah, I mean, what are you doing? You're getting people in touch with the center of themselves, you know, their their life force, you know, the part of them that feels, why do people come to a show? Well, you want to be reminded of how it feels to be really alive, you know? And, you know, that's what a great 3-minute pop song does. In 3 minutes, you get the entire picture. You get the possibility of life on Earth and what that can mean and what it can do for you and do for others. It's just encapsulated in 3 minutes of what feels like nothingness, but for some reason has had the power to inspire and lift up and just bring you closer to Godhead or whatever, you know, you're pursuing. So I always feel that's our job. Our job is, you know, we are repairmen and we're reminders. You come to our show and we will, I've always figured I don't get paid necessarily to play this song or that song or this song. I get paid to be as present as I can conceivably be on every night that I'm out there. Because if I'm there and I'm alive, then I know you're feeling it too.
Now, this is my wife's question, and it's caused some complication in my marriage, and I think it's probably the question that some of you have out here, and it may be an idea for your second book. What is your workout routine? Because this is ridiculous. And I don't want any broad generalities. I want to know everything you do.
It's all mental, you know?
No, that's got to be
It's all about what is and isn't going right up here, you know? My own take on it was, initially, music was the first way that I kind of medicated my anxieties. And so I used it, being a good Catholic boy, of course, as a purification ritual, which we are all taught to do. And I would simply go out and play until I just, you know, burned up or felt incandescent inside. And at the end of the night, that's what momentarily satiated all the jagged little pieces of my puzzle that I had running around inside of me. And really, that hasn't changed over the years. I basically work till, I always say exhaustion is my friend, you know, and partly because when I was done working the night, the next day, I'd feel incredibly clear and quite free and simply too tired to be depressed, you know. It was like, I mean, you got to have some energy to be depressed. You got to be able to get out there and search through the weeds for the one thing that's going to, you know, bust your ass that particular day. And then you got to put a lot of energy into that thing. Well, if you're too tired to do that, you're feeling better, you know, you're feeling pretty good.
Bruce Springsteen, singer, songwriter, and bandleader. I spoke with him at the New Yorker Festival, and in a minute, we'll talk about how Springsteen's troubled relationship with his father fueled his very best songs. I'm David Remnick, and this is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Sandy, the fireworks are hailing over Little Eden tonight. Forcing a light into all those stony faces left stranded on this warm July. Down in time, the circuits fall, a switchblade lovers so fast, so shiny, so sharp.
I'm David Remnick. Today's program was recorded at the New Yorker Festival, our annual blowout featuring dozens of performances and interviews. This week, we're spending the hour entirely with Bruce Springsteen. When we spoke, he had just published his autobiography, Born to Run. In the book, he's very frank about his difficulties with his parents, his father's mental illness, and his own lifelong struggle with depression.
One other thing that you were doing on stage was having a conversation with your father. There's a lot of songs about him. When you asked him which songs he liked the best, he said he liked the songs about him.
Yeah.
How did that help to do that, not to a shrink, which came along a little later, but to be on stage and as a kind of warm-up to a lot of your songs, you would have these kind of spoken stories, some of which seem reflected almost, if not word for word, but very directly in the memoir, which they seemed absolutely true.
Well, that was it was an imperfect way to communicate with somebody who you love and whose love you're seeking. You know, but it was the only thing that I had. I was always trying to sort out what our relationship was about, and so I think I initially, obviously, Steinbeck's East of Eden, and I said, "Oh, well, I get that. You know, I've had some of that," and so I cast this a little bit in. You know, in that way, and it was a way that I could talk about our relationship without, I was never going to have a direct conversation about it because it just wasn't possible. My dad was very ill and wasn't susceptible to doing something like that, even on his best days, you know. So I had my music, which is where I went to sort out everything in those days, and so that was naturally where I went to sort that out, and I just started to write about it. It worked out somewhat in the end, you know.
Bruce, how did you become a more politically engaged person? That seemed to happen over time. How did that happen and why?
Well, we grew up like that. If you grew up in the 60s, you know, politics was... it was just in the air. It was a part of your cultural experience. And we were doing things for, we were playing benefits for anti-Vietnam War benefits when we were 19 or 20. You know? And so that was a very big part of just growing up at that time. And it really came up out of my life experience. I didn't have some... It wasn't any eureka moment, or it just came out of living and growing.
There was a piece in the Times, and it went through various landscapes in your songs. Youngstown, Badlands, South Dakota, Johnstown, Pennsylvania, which is the scene of the river, Darlington, South Carolina. These are all Trump voting areas. And white working class areas have changed dramatically in their political orientation since the days of, say, Bobby Kennedy. Mm-hmm. What do you make of that? And do you feel that you have an acute hold on some of these landscapes as you once might have?
Well, I think if you look at the history of Youngstown or any of the places you've mentioned, you see that basically I've written about the last 40 years of deindustrialization and globalization. Hit a lot of people very, very, very hard. And... there was never, their concerns and their problems and their issues were never addressed by either party, really. So there's this sea of people out there who are waiting and hoping and looking for something that's going to bring some meaning and back into their lives, you know. So it's not a surprise if someone comes along and says, "You want your jobs back? I'm going to bring them back. You're uncomfortable with the Browning of America, I'm going to build a wall, keep all these folks out." You want to hear these kinds of solutions to your problems. Unfortunately, they're fallacious, and it's a con job, you know. But I completely understand why a voice like that would be appealing.
I want to go back to if it seemed to me that there was a kind of framing in this book, that if the hero of the first part of the book in some ways was your mother, Adele, there's a heroic presence in the latter part of the book with your wife, Patty. And you're...
Let's hear it for her.
And she is a presence in the band, but you're the singular... primary presence in the band, and then you come home where things are not as ecstatic. Oh. And she's the boss, I gather. But also, and not to make it too programmatic, but what holds you together? That you've had some tough times and tough years. This is not a book that has a fake happy ending where depression is concerned. That this is something that, even if you're carried across a sea of people, surfing the crowd and standing ovation after standing ovation, that has no effect whatsoever on the next morning, necessarily.
If only, in my wildest dreams, you know. You're that person on stage for 3 hours. Most people get
four, Bruce.
Yeah.
Some, four.
So Patty's got to live with me the other 20 hours of the day, and most people see the best of me, and she unfortunately bumps into the worst of me. Hopefully not that regularly, but sometimes. But Pete, we connected right from the very, very beginning. Patty came down to New Jersey in 1974 before the Born to Run tour, and she came in and auditioned. We were going to take a singer out at the time, which we didn't end up doing, but we sat at the piano together, and she played me some of her songs, and this was when I was 24 years old, and she was probably 20, and then we saw each other regularly after that, and I always kid Patty. I say, yeah, we get along because before you were you, you were me. You know, she was a musician. She was independent. She was very,
Be careful.
You know, she was just very single-minded pursuit of her work, and we just had a lot in common, which has sustained us for a long time, and she's needless to say that when I've had my rough times, she's been there and continues to be there 110%, you know. So
hey, Bruce, you have three kids who are grown, and I have to think that no matter how great a father and mother, it's got to be a little weird on college visiting day, or you're driving down this avenue or that, and people are screaming Bruce. And how do you kind of keep that at bay for your children? At one point, you describe the book.
It's not as hard as people think. You know, a lot of it is how you think about it. I mean, basically, we just go about our business. If something a little strange starts to happen, you can kind of move away from it, or you calm it down, or it comes up once in a while. But we've been pretty lucky.
Didn't you tell your kids that you're like Barney, the purple dinosaur?
Well, that was when they were little. You know, they were wondering, you know, why...
It didn't work when they were in their 20s.
Why do people want you to scribble your name? Pre-selfie, why do people want you to scribble your name on a piece of paper? And they were just puzzled by people approaching us, you know. And I said, well, to explain it to them, I said, well, okay, you know Barney, the dinosaur. Right? Are you interested in Barney? He said, yeah, well, people are interested in me in the same way, except grown-up people. So that actually... Yeah.
And that worked?
It actually made a lot of sense to them. And and so they were pretty divorced from it. I think one day Evan came home and said, Dad, what's 10th Avenue Freeze Out? So I said, 10th Avenue Freeze Out? Where'd you hear that? You know, I heard it at school. Somebody said their parents are always singing 10th Avenue Freeze Out. So I said, well... I don't know, I'll show you what it is. I got the guitar, and I started to play it to him kind of Barney style. He said, no, Dad, play it for real, all right? So I played him the song. I said, that's it. That's 10th Avenue Freeze-Out, you know? And it seemed to satisfy him. And there was a moment when the children were actually saying, okay, we're old enough now to where we need to be a little bit of a part of what you're doing, and we need to understand that. And Patty was really good at saying, because at the time I was so overprotective of the children that I would just basically hide them. And she'd say, look, you know, they're going to grow up wondering, why were we being hidden all the time?
In the attic.
And so she said, yeah, they may get their picture taken, but it's more important for them to feel that we stand as one, as a family. And from then on, you know, we went about our business, and I think the kids felt better if you took their hand and you, you know, whatever, walked to your car or your van. Even if somebody took a picture, they felt better that you were claiming them, and they were they knew they were an intimate part of even that part of your life.
One of the great stupid questions I've ever asked in an interview, and there are many. As I said to you some years ago, well, you know, you jump off the piano and you run up and down the ramps and you crowd surf, and there's probably going to come a time, probably, not necessarily definitely, that you might find that when you wake up in the morning, as I do, you feel like you've been beaten by a baseball bat. And all I do is pick cartoons for a living, and I don't do that. And I said, what are you going to do when that happens? And you said, well, I won't do that anymore. Which was a stupid question, but can you see yourself becoming like an, you know, years and years from now, like an old blues man sitting in a chair doing your songs instead of jumping around like a maniac?
Well, part of it is you have to not mind feeling like you've been beaten up with a baseball. So pain has to become your friend, but I don't know, you know, I, as I say in the book, you know, I forget, I have a piece where I say, well, you know, the day may come when, and when this happens, and when that happens, but not tonight, and not right now. So, that's the way I approach it. I also will have no problem whatsoever sitting in a nice little chair with my acoustic guitar, knocking out the songs from Nebraska or something.
Bruce,
there is no end in sight so far.
I've got one. Why are you booing him? I've got one more question. You gave a speech in Austin some years ago and said, I knew I was never going to be like Woody Guthrie. I liked Elvis. I liked the pink Cadillac too much. I like the simplicity and the tossed-off temporary feeling of pop hits. I like a big noise. And in my own way, I like the luxuries and the comforts of being a star. Yeah, it ain't
you
bad,
are correct, is it? Sir. I don't have anything to add to that. You got it exactly right.
Bruce Springsteen. Thank you.
Thanks.
Bruce Springsteen is the author of the autobiography Born to Run, along with I don't know how many best-selling albums. And currently he's starring in the show Springsteen on Broadway on, you might have guessed it, Broadway. This is Baby I from the album Chapter and Verse. It's an archival song from way before the E Street Band.